This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle, my guest tonight. What a treat it is to have the great jazz pianist Monty Alexander join us to talk about his love of not only music, but boxing. Monty, thanks for joining us on Sports Jam.
I'm having a great time today.
Monty, where did this all start for you, this love of boxing?
Well, I don't have a perfect answer. I just know that from I was a kid and I saw local boxing in my hometown of Kingston, Jamaica, I don't know, maybe even from 10 years old, my dad took me to a couple of prize fights in Jamaica. And then one time, maybe when I was about 12, 13, Sugar Ray Robinson, the greatest pound-for-pound fighter of all time, as most analysts and experts like to say, he came to Jamaica and he fought an exhibition match. And it was about the time when he was winding down all out of boxing because he had done so many great things. So I the flame was lit. I became a real fan. And the funny thing is, when I saw the lights shining down on that ring, it was an open-air event. You know, you could see the flies in the air over with the searchlight, the floodlight shining down where the boxers were fighting. It just made me feel like I was also watching musicians on a stage playing music, and that excitement I would feel when I saw them. So it became like, hey, this is the same kind of experience. And I felt that when those men were moving to and fro, throwing a punch, avoiding a punch, offense, defense, and the way they would move to avoid something, to me was like, wait a minute, this is like rhythm. This is about rhythm. How do you approach the rhythm when you're playing the way I love music, and the drummer is playing a certain phrase and the bass player is playing? There's this thing about rhythm and how you approach it. So it was all connected. And I just became a big boxing nut. And when I came to the USA in 61, I happened to be in that area not far from an auditorium where every Thursday night we would see local fighters in Miami Beach, actually. And not far from there, there was a place called the Fifth Street Gym. And at the Fifth Street Gym, all the local fighters would work out there, and I would go up there and watch them. And that's the first time I saw then Cassius Clay. He had just come out of Louisville. He had fought quite a few people, and he was completely undefeated, and he was charismatic. Everybody just fell in love with Clay at the time.
And the first time you saw him fight, did you think this guy was special?
The first time I saw him, I didn't see him fight. I actually met him, and I was in the foyer, the outside of this auditorium, and he was standing with a guy that was a well-known fighter in Jamaica. His name was Alan Harmon. And Alan Harmon, he was a light heavyweight, and they were together. In fact, I think they were sharing a room together over in what was called Liberty City in Miami. And I knew Alan Harmon. I didn't know Cassius Clay, right? And I saw him, and they were so beautifully attired with a great suit and tie, and they were sharp as cats in place, you know? And man, I said, these guys super duper here. And I went back into the auditorium waiting for the next bout. And I was sitting behind two older guys who must have been from New York. They knew everything, so to speak. And I remember they pointed to the two men as they were walking in to witness the next bout. And I'm sitting there and I heard them saying, and one guy said, hey, you see those guys walking in? You see that guy over there? He's got a big mouth, and I wish somebody would shut his mouth, you know, blah, blah. And I thought he was talking about Alan Harmon.
But he was talking about Cassius Clay.
He was talking about Cassius Clay, the mouth that roared, boy. And from that moment, I became so, you know, like the whole world that knew, I like to say that, they were so smitten with everything that came out of this incredible human being who was not just about how to throw a punch and how to be a boxer, but how to be a person. And how he was affecting, you know, his sense of humor, his wit, his street wisdom, the way he loved people, young and old. You know, he took time out for helping older people and kids. So he just became a favorite person for me. But it wasn't just Ali. It was the whole scene of boxing that I enjoyed. And up to this day, I'm right on it with Floyd Mayweather and whoever is out there. I made a lot of friends, you know. I got to know Archie Moore very well.
We're here with Monty Alexander on Sports Jam. The last fight that Muhammad Ali fought as Cassius Clay was against Sonny Liston in Miami, but you weren't there. You were in New York City.
Well, I was always, whatever was going on, I would turn to the sports page. What's going on? What's going on with Ali, Muhammad Ali? For a while, Muhammad X, you know, because of all the controversies, America wasn't... establishment America was so much against this man and who he was, how he was, what he was saying. And I remember the night I was playing at the Playboy Club, but I remember they broadcast it over the closed circuit. I went to a closed circuit fight. I never missed one Muhammad Ali fight. I saw every single one, whether it was Wide World of Sports, whether it was a closed circuit fight, and I went to several bouts live, and I went to the training camp many times. I remember Milt Jackson and I were playing in Silver Spring, Maryland at the Bird's Nest, and Ali was going to fight the Spanish heavyweight Evangelista. So we all went to this training camp, and there were all those guys were there. Bondini was there, and Gene Kilroy was there, of course. You know, and the first time I saw Sugar Ray Leonard, he had just won the Olympics. And he was just like a kid hanging around. It was Ray Leonard. And Larry Holmes was one of the sparring partners. So Larry had not become a complete professional in the ranks as yet, you know. So that was a thrill, you know. And I was in Munich, Germany when he fought Richard Dunn. I went to the training camp. And there was Jimmy Ellis, his boyhood friend, you know. And I hung out with, they came to the jazz club where I was playing, the Domicile, right there in Munich. They were looking for ladies, though. They didn't want to hear no jazz.
You know, you need your wonderful hands to play the piano, but did you ever want to put those boxing gloves on?
Look, just like with sword fighting, Errol Flynn was my big hero, and I wanted to get a sword and start doing the sword fighting thing. Or I wanted to be, you know, but like my cowboy heroes, and I'd go in front of the mirror and just dream I was the fastest gun alive. But boxing, it was a dream thing, you know. And I had a few fights in school and got busted up, and I busted up the other guy too pretty good, I think. But I never went out of my way to get into the boxing at all. I had a pair of gloves, and I used to think, maybe I'll go spar with somebody. But my wife, actually, she'd be at the gym. She knows how to turn a punch and knock you out, I tell you, man.
But you took some kids out in school then, huh?
Well, I mean, you know, you're rumbling, you're on the floor fighting with some kid who said something you didn't like, and big trouble, you know, but then you make up, become friends. But the whole boxing people, all those people are such a special bunch. They're like there's a bond. They're for the most part, the kindest and the greatest people in the world, you know. They're working hard to keep healthy and stay strong so they can knock you out, you know, but no bad vibes. I always love when there's a bout and these guys were pummeling each other, and at the end of the fight, the guy goes over to the corner, the loser's corner, and there's this, on some occasion, most occasions, there's this human connection with the two guys, and there's like we're brothers here, you know. I don't hate you. You're my guy. You're my brother. So we just made some money and we put on a good fight for the people. And when it doesn't go like that, I'm just disappointed that their animosities remain, because that's part of how what drum builds up the gate. When the fight fans say, "Oh man, he hates so and so. We're gonna have a heck of a fight tonight," you know. But every Saturday, when I'm not playing, you know, and if I am in Europe, then we get, you know, I tape it or I watch it 3 a.m. Well, that was years ago. Now you get everything on the internet.
How did the relationship with Archie Moore start?
Well, I was playing with Dizzy in the United Nations band, and we passed through San Diego. And I saw Dizzy in the lobby. It was like about 12 noon. We had the job that night to go play at the San Diego Zoo, of all places. And I said, "Hey, where you going, Diz?" He says, "I'm going to Archie's house, the Mongoose. I'm going to his house. We're going to have lunch." I said, "Archie Moore, that's your friend?" And I realized they were buddies from way, way back. And Archie was a big jazz lover. Actually, I found out later, he had a bass fiddle. He wanted to play bass. And he lived in San Diego, and that's where he had his training camp. And in fact, when Clay, as was his name at the time, was coming up, the Louisville Commission, those guys there, they sent him out to Archie's camp. But Archie had Ali sweeping up the floor and doing all these things like you're in boot camp. And wow. Ali didn't like that. He didn't like that. He
said, no, I bet not.
And eventually, a few years later, they fought. And Archie was already in his mid-40s, late-40s, maybe 50 at the time. And Ali, it was hurtful for me to see, you know, there was Archie knocked out like in the sixth round or something like that. But Archie was a wonderful guy. And I met him at the Evander Holyfield George Foreman fight in Atlantic City. I wasn't there for the fight. I had to be somewhere else. But I went to the night before and I hung out with Archie all night. I went up to him and instead of talking boxing, I said, chap, I eased on up by him in the lobby. And he said, yeah. I said, chap. I said, I'm a friend of Dizzy's. And we hung out, man. He said, come
on. That's all you needed to say, right?
That's right. And we hung out till 3 a.m. in his room. And he just told me his life story, a version of. And he says, you know, because he saw that Evander and George had managers. And he says, I had no manager. You know, if I had had a manager, boy, I would have this and that. Because he was a real, call it a renegade to that whole scene. He did his own thing. And he, you know, and to this day, and here's what happened. Here's a jazz story there. While we were together, he started talking about one of his best boyhood friends, Clark Terry. Clark and Archie were friends from school. Clark tried to be a boxer. He was a boxer. He boxed. But, of course, when you're a trumpet player, you've got to protect your mouth, right? So they stayed friends, and there I was with Archie Moore calling up Clark on the phone, and the love they had for each other, and to hear, as you might know, Archie's name was the Mongoose. And then when I would see Clark after that, Clark started calling me the Mongoose, especially because in Jamaica, the Mongoose is such a part of the nature there, you know? And the Mongoose is because you can't find him. That's the one animal that could outfox a cobra. That's how Archie was referred to, because he was so slick in the ring. But, yeah, that was a wonderful story. Years later, I was playing at Gillies and Miles Davis came in and he must have liked my piano playing. I was flattered, of course. He invited me up to hang out with him. I'd go to his house and anything goes. You know, there was his buddies, his hanger-oners, and he always was talking boxing and he and I talked boxing. And on a couple of occasions, I went with Miles, just he and I, to the garden to a boxing match. I would go there with him and In a little while, he might see some people he knew. He disappeared, you know. But I hung out with Miles a bit, and I was around him. I remember during some boxing matches that were. I remember one of the times was just before Ali was going to fight Foreman, and that was a big time for all of us, you know. And I saw Ali on the train 6 months before going down to Washington, and he was hanging out with two friends of his, as he was about to start a new business, ice cream company or something. He was going to lend his name to it. And I ended up sitting on the train with Muhammad Ali, just sitting there next to him, talking with him for like about half an hour. And he was telling me, reading Sufi poetry and talking about it. I asked him, I said, champ, you ever listen to jazz? And he said, not really, but he loved Sam Cooke. He and Sam Cooke were the best of friends. And I saw a film where Ali played some boogie-woogie on the piano. So he loved the music, yeah.
That's great. And you mentioned Jilly Rizzo, the club owner in New York City, who basically just touched that club owner and really started an amazing career for Monty Alexander.
Well, I just, wherever I was, you know, if I kept my mouth shut and played my cards right, so to speak, and, you know, good things are happening because I always went after being around good folk, you know, and I was given many opportunities. And when I met Jillian, Mr. Frank Sinatra, and I came to New York, it was a great thrill, of course, but they, you know, were very kind to me. I was 19, 20, 21 years old, and I was there when a lot of famous musicians and entertainers were at the club, and I knew from the get-go that Jilly, like most people in those days, were big boxing fans too. Sinatra was a big boxing fan. He managed a couple of fighters. You might remember he took the photographs on the cover of Life magazine of Ali, Joe Frazier, the first one at the Garden, the greatest fighter, the fight of the century, they called it. And I spoke at a bar when I'm standing there next to Sinatra and asking him he's telling me about his greatest hero, Joe Louis, who he, Sinatra made a big difference to when he was down on his luck after he had even been a referee at wrestling, of all things. He wrestled when he had no money, you know, that Sinatra got him a job at Caesar's Palace greeting the fans, and it gave Joe a great ending to his life. You know, his last few years, he was a celebrity. People couldn't wait to just meet him.
You're listening to Sports Jam on WBGO, The Jazz Source. My guest tonight is the great pianist and boxing fan, Monty Alexander.
There is a light in the sky that some people can't see. But if you look hard enough, one day we'll agree. This is no time for us to turn away when something's wrong. And as the river rolls on, another battle's begun. And the river rolls on, rolls on.
Monty, it seems you know a little bit about every famous boxer, including Mike Tyson.
Last time I saw Jilly was the night that Mike Tyson fought Mitch Green. Mitch Green, who Tyson had met in a boutique up in Harlem. And he had inflicted some injury on him, and there was this terrible thing about Mitch Green. And that was after the fight. So they never made up after the fight that night. But Jilly was there, and he invited me down to ringside, and I sat with him.
We had Mike Tyson here on Sports Jam, and have you seen his one-man show?
I have seen the HBO show that he did, and needless to say, what a wonderful turnaround to a man's challenging time, you know, all that he went through, because, you know, he was really taken advantage of by various situations, because he just approached everything from a very childlike situation and never had, I mean, Customato showed him everything. He was so grateful, but I think away from that, he wasn't getting good advice from the people around him.
You have seen all these great fighters. You know their moves. When you attack a piano, who do you remind yourself of as a boxer? Who would you say?
If I'm doing what I want to do and I feel like I did what I did and the kind of way I want to do it, Ali is a big inspiration to me, because it's now you see it, now you don't. You know, he come out round five, he's doing this. For round six, he changes gears. He's a different fighter. He's running away. The round seven, he might be rope-a-doping. He defies all the odds, you know, what he did. And he just told you his story, how he wanted to tell it. And that's what I wanted to do on the piano. And I remember for a while, I was interviewed by a British jazz interview with a magazine. The guy said, "Who's your favorite piano player?" I said, "Muhammad Ali." What do you mean? I didn't know he played piano. I said, "If he played the piano, he's my hero." You know,
you are someone that could really compare boxing eras. We're in a much different time now. Boxing is not as popular as it used to be. You mentioned that Floyd Mayweather is a boxer that you follow. Do you have any suggestions for the boxing world how they can get back to the glory days?
Boy, that's a good one. But I'll say that it's far away from the community of people who lived at a time when, especially, as you know, so many of the fighters were African-American, and they were cornered over into an area where they weren't accepted by the masses, and just a terrible time. But there was a strong bond between jazz musicians and boxers. Now, boxers couldn't be sitting at the bar juicing away like so many of our forebears did in jazz and music in general, but they could hang out pretty good too, and they admired each other. And I know stories of Joe Louis with Ben Webster. You know, Ben was a big kind of a guy, and he liked to punch on you when he was feeling happy or something. And one night they say he hit Joe at the bar in Birdland or someplace, and it was a knee-jerk reaction, reflex, and Joe just, boop, one shot, little punch to solar plexus, and Ben Webster was out cold. but they loved each other, you know, they were friends. And as a Charles, they tell me, he was a jazz fan. In recent times, Shane Mosley, I never forget when I was watching a Shane Mosley fight, and they were playing Cannonball Adderley music as he came into the ring. You know, the fighters, like, you know, now everybody's, most people are hip-hopping, you know. And as far as the community, what ended up happening, and I say this cautiously, when the schools became the driving force in what we call jazz today, what a wonderful thing. So many young people wanted to have a taste of this legacy. Go to school and hear a good thinking guy tell them about harmony and how do you play this and how do you play that. But it took away that thing where young musicians went out of their way to be with the older guys and hang out and try to just go out of their way to try to meet Mr. Ray Brown or Mr. Dizzy. Can I come to the show? We're like, you know, and that sort of thing changed because now they had access not to the people, which is what earlier guys had to do, but to the knowledge of the music, the thing that was in the books, where a fine trumpet player who was playing in Maynard Ferguson's band didn't have much going, and he learned how to write the music down. And next thing you know, he was a teacher at some school, and he got his name with degrees, and it's a wonderful thing. And he was teaching a lot of young people about how to play. And I always believe those people are going to give him a tip, but they're not going to teach you how to play. You got to find out how to play yourself. It's your own personal experience. But what I'm saying is the boxers and the sports people back in the 40s and the 50s, there was more of an occasion or situations where those people might meet up and congregate. Sugar Ray had a club in Harlem, and Miles would be up there, and all the musicians, you know, Sugar Ray Robinson's had a club, you know, and the fighters would be there, the boxers would be there, the jazz guys would be there, the rhythm and blues guys would be there, and there was more community among those people. And it wasn't just African-Americans, it was the whole scene in general, you know. People like Rocky Marciano and Graziano and Jake LaMotta, they had their world, but there was community. But it wasn't with an academic roof over your head, you know? So that's my theory. And I don't know how to change that because life is what it is. It's what it is. You can't turn back the clock. But
let's turn back the clock a little bit if we can and have some fun here. If you and all these fighters would be in their prime, in their heyday, what would be the ultimate boxing match? You can pick anybody but they have to be in their prime and they were able to fight each other. And you can pick any era.
Oh, boy. Man, you're throwing some doozies at me here. Well, when we talk about the greatest and the greatest and the greatest and the slickest and the fastest, you know, and of course there's different weight divisions. But when you hear people from before my time and they would talk about Sugar Ray Robinson, how he fought, I would like to see Floyd Mayweather and Sugar Ray Robinson because there's no doubt about it. Ray Robinson, it could be the most boring fight you ever saw because they're so slick with how to avoid. You know, they may never confront. You know, but the greatest men, I think, are Jack Johnson. I think Jack Dempsey, and you would like to. I remember when there was that computer fight with Marciano and Ali. It was a jive thing because they never met, you know, but it was
right.
A computer thing, and I don't even know why that happened, but it had to do with money, you know. Let's make some money with it.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, Ali even had a wrestling match with a Japanese wrestler, Inoki, I think his name was. But what would be great fights? Oh, man. I think to see Ray Robinson at work and Willie Pep, Archie Moore, all those guys boxing each other. But you know the bond of humanity was very strong with them people. They always respected each other, but for sheer skill with pugilism, Yeah, see Jack Johnson and Joe Louis in there together. You know, that could be something.
What was the best fight you saw? It didn't have to be anybody big name. What was the best fight you ever witnessed?
Man, that's another one. I mean, every now and then I see the best fight I've ever seen. And it's the best fight.
That's why you're a fan, right?
Yeah, they're all the best fight, except for the fights that are just plain old. And it all comes down to rhythm. You know, you can talk about jazz musicians, and if the rhythm that drummer has in him doesn't connect to make a happy thing with the guy, the bass player or the piano player, you have it might be, whoa, they play together, it's great, but it didn't necessarily take off. It's the same thing in the ring.
You have a new project that's coming out on April 8th. Tell us about it.
Oh, man. This is Harlem Kingston Express 2, a name I came up because when you're an immigrant, you come from another place and you grow up with another way of life and thinking, and you read in the news or you see it on in the movie news, a place called America. This is this way over there place. You know, will I ever see America? I'm thinking me in the 50s, right? But you bring the passion about your heritage, the music too, not just the music, but the food you eat, the way you look at life, playing cricket, you know, not baseball, but cricket. And you want to adapt. So those early years, I started to try to adapt. And when it came to the bandstand, I realized I was with American guys from different lifestyles, you know, different, not just one section of people, but, you know, as you know, there's different cultures, lifestyles. I was around the Italian guys a lot. I was around the Jewish guys a lot. I was around African Americans a lot. I was around, you know, and to me, it's just one beautiful melting pot, just like Jamaica, right? So how do I fit in America? The best way I knew how was music, and I would be on the bandstand, and I could fit in, I could join, be with the big boys myself, you know. There I'm with Milt Jackson and Ray Brown, and they like it, I'm liking it, and we're having a ball together. But they don't know this other part of me, which is about, I say, coconuts and mangoes and rice and peas, and I would try to bring the music thing into my playing and what I was doing, going way back to the 60s and the 70s, because my first album was in 65 at Pacific Jazz. And, you know, I found, hey, on that album I did a little tune called Jamaica Shake, you know, I'm throwing it. But the Americans, the great jazz men, they never really knew what that was. It's a cultural thing. So in recent years, about 15 years ago, I started to bond with the younger and the newer versions of Jamaican musicians. Year being my 70th birthday in June, we're going to have a big night at BB King's in June, and I'm bringing up some of my early friends from the reggae scene pre-Bob Marley, and also people post-Bob Marley. But the thing on June the 12th at BB King's is going to be a real doozy as far as fantastic people coming together.
We have to have you back. We could talk for hours and hours.
We could, yeah.
The great pianist Monty Alexander, huge boxing fan, you know, and I still think he's going to be an analyst somewhere. We're going to hear him on one of these events coming up quickly.
I like that.
Thank you so much for joining us on Sports Jam. What a pleasure to have you here.
Me too, brother. Brother Doug. Thanks so much.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the shows by going to WBGO.org/SportsJam or find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on iTunes. Until then, I'll see you at the game.